On Friday, even Garba Shehu, the president's media aide, called it a, quote, deteriorating security situation. Which brings me to our big hard fact for today. Last week, terrorists attacked soldiers of the Guards Brigade in Abuja. The Guards Brigade protects the president, his family, and key facilities in the capital. They are elite troops in the Nigerian army, and that's why many Nigerians are asking if terrorists can attack the Guards Brigade, is anywhere in Abuja safe? The anxiety about insecurity is now so high that minority members of the National Assembly are openly talking about impeaching the president, who they say isn't responding seriously enough to the situation. So for the rest of the hour, we're talking about what Garba Shehu called the deteriorating security situation, what the present administration and the next administration can do to rectify it. And my guest is a former assistant director of the State Security Service, Dennis Amakri. Welcome to Hard Facts, Dennis. Good to have you on the show.
Yeah, good evening. How are you today?
I'm very, very well. I do hope you're enjoying your time away from Nigeria.
Oh, well, I can see better now.
Dennis, talk to me about this Guards Brigade attack. How significant is it that the Guards Brigade was attacked?
I need to make some clarification. It was not that the Guards Brigade was there and the terrorists came and attacked them. That's not the story.
Right.
Because that's what people are hearing right now. But what actually happened was that the Guards Brigade, they are responsible for the security of the FCT.
Right.
Including the seat of government, which includes the seat of government.
Right.
Now, they had this intelligence report that there are some terrorists that were trying to attack a university down in Abuja, on the outskirts of Abuja. So they went in pursuit of them, and of course they were going all the way. They were pursuing them until they got to a brook, a small river, where their vehicles cannot cross again. So they were stuck there, and then of course some of them followed them with their on foot, not knowing that these guys were luring them into their enclave, whereby they surrounded them and started firing. There was a serious dogfight, and then, of course, there were some casualties. But all the same, I praise the Guard Brigade because they were not just sitting down there before these people came in there. And the whole idea of protection is to be up and doing. It's not a matter of going around and sitting down and waiting for terrorists to come and attack you. So I think that's the clarification I want to make.
Okay. Before this attack or this fight, we saw the attack on Kuje prison, right? And the freeing of Boko Haram suspects there. The president promised that heads will roll. So far, no heads have rolled. Nobody at Kuje prison or the correction service or the interior ministry has been sacked. So I have to ask, in your expert opinion, what should have happened after a prison break like this?
Well, after the prison break, I was on an interview on a national TV with some people, and I suggested it. In fact, I made mention of it that for the correctional centers in the country, about 8 of them had been attacked after Owerri, and it started there. They were very, very much at the disposal of intelligence, and instead of going ahead and strengthening or, heightening the security of those places, they sit down there like limp dogs and allow this to happen. If I were the controller general of the prison service, I would have resigned. And that's the honorable thing to do. But apparently he sat down there because he knew that nothing is going to happen to him. And of course, he's still there. But that's how we take our jobs very, very unseriously. Because it is a national shame that Kuje prison, which is, I think, the premier prison in the federal capital, where even we have very high-profile prisoners, will be attacked. And then, of course, there was no response. And they finished what they are doing and took some people out of the prison and left.
You know, what's interesting is that Deputy Speaker Idris Washe said that before the Kuje prison attack, the SSS, your former agency, shared 44 different intelligence reports with them. In your opinion, your expert opinion, what factors could lead to the government failing to act on those reports?
Well, who are we referring to as government now? You know, because the people that produce
the report are also government.
Yes, and who received it is also government.
So who is supposed to act on it? And how often is it that those people do not act on it?
Okay. Now, what happens is that when the DSS receives intelligence reports, mm-hmm. and they produce it to inform the consumer, and the consumer in this case is the correctional service. Mm. Now, the correctional service, when they get a report like that, mm-hmm. what we expect them to do is to harden their prisons. I don't know whether the Controller General of the Prison Service had been asking for funds that he didn't get, but those prisons are very old. Some of them are pre-independence. And of course, the walls, when you look at the wall that was blown out, it's cement blocks. Mm-hmm. Cement blocks are not used for the perimeter walls of a prison. You use concrete, you know, concrete casts. That's what they use so that, you know, even if you attempt to break it, it will be very, very hard to do. Hmm. And then the height of the walls are supposed to be 9 feet and above. Hmm. These ones were not up to that. And then, of course, it is supposed to be fenced with barbed wires. I don't know where those barbed wires, the old ones, have been removed or replaced. The watchtowers are supposed to be manned. Hmm. And the lights are supposed to be working 24/7. Hmm. But we all know, maybe NEPA has taken light. So there is no light there, and they are in darkness. And then, of course, besides physical security, the procedures are faulty.
Okay.
Kuje prison has a lot of telephones in it.
Okay.
A prison is not supposed to have telephones. Okay. Telephone service is not supposed to be available to prisoners.
Okay.
But you have a lot of telephones in there. And these people are talking constantly with people outside, telling their wives what to cook and bring for them for dinner, you know, and telling their other colleagues that, look, oh, the guards are not around. Usually some army people used to come here, but every 4 o'clock they are gone.
Mm.
You know, that kind of conversation might be going on.
Mm.
And then, of course, it was very, very, it was an explosive that was waiting to explode.
Mm.
And that was what happened. So, as we talk, I don't know if they've gone ahead to do the needful or they are still waiting for another prison to be attacked again. You know, and head should roll.
So,
as far as I'm concerned.
So if the SSS, you know, gets intelligence reports that this is about to go down, right? The first people they share that report with are the consumers. In this case, the Kuje prison. Say they share it with the prisons, and the prisons do not harden the prison. Is the SSS going to do anything else? Are they expected to do anything else? Share that information with anyone else?
No. They don't supervise the prisons.
Hmm.
You know, it's not in their purview to supervise you and say, hey, why don't you do what I said you should do?
Mm.
You know, so it's not in their purview.
Okay.
Now, when such reports go, they are not going only to the prison services.
Okay.
They also go to the government. In this case, it goes to the Federal Capital Territory, you know, or the state government.
Mm.
They also have these reports.
Okay.
And that's where the state governments will come out and say, okay, you're a federal institution.
Mm-hmm.
Who is responsible for the prisons?
Mm-hmm.
Minister of Internal Affairs. And then the Minister of Internal Affairs, who also must have got that report,
mm-hmm.
will go ahead and then say, okay, let us do something about this case.
Mm-hmm.
But you see the chain of laxity, whereby all these people got it and nobody did anything about it until it happened, and they are still sitting down there and not doing anything.
So you're saying that it's not just the prison that would have gotten a report such as this. You'd have also had the Ministry of Interior receive a report like this.
Yes.
And what should the Ministry of Interior have done when they got that report?
Well, you are the supervising ministry.
Okay.
If you are the supervising ministry and there's a report like that,
mm-hmm.
you will tell them. Normally, the first thing the minister will tell them is, hey, controller of prisons, have you also got the report that the DSS sent to us? They say, yes, we got it. And so what are you going to do about it? Okay, sir, we are going to harden the security of the prisons. We find out that from our assessment, the walls are not very strong, or the lights are not working, or, you know, we don't have enough staff to keep watch and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then the supervising minister will now tell them, okay, go ahead, do a proposal and let me know what you would need. That's how it works. But here, everybody sees it and keep it there, or maybe the controller might have gone to the minister and said, you know, we've got the report and we are doing something about
it.
That's one. Yeah, that's one language I hate, seriously. You know, we're doing something on it. We're on top of it, you know, and nothing is going on.
In a situation like that, are there escalation mechanisms in place? So if, say, you know, the people who are supposed to get these reports get these reports, and within a time frame or a duration, they're not doing anything about the reports they've gotten, is there some method of escalation that ensures that something is done?
Well, the thing is this. When a minister gets a report like that, mm-hmm. he's supposed to do something about it.
Okay.
Because that's what he is the minister. Now, if maybe he lacks fund, the controller has come to him and to harden all the prisons, he needs about 1 billion. Now, he tells the minister, and the minister looks around, he does not have that kind of money. Then he takes it to the Council of State,
okay,
where they have a meeting. And then put it there, and the president will hear about it, and the president will say, okay, Minister of Finance, do you think you can get them some money? You know? And again, it depends now on priority again, because they'll say, what do we do now? Do we spend 1 billion on prisons, or we can put this 1 billion on PVC cards, give it to INEC, to do PVC. Depending on the kind of priorities that you give, or say, okay, we cannot give you 1 billion, we'll give you half of it or one quarter of it. So that is where governance is active. But you find out that we don't know in the base where this had got lost.
Yeah.
Did he take it to the Council of State? Maybe or maybe not. Did the controller report it to him? Maybe, maybe not. So you find out that everybody sits back until something happens. Then public will raise hell. Oh, you know, this is a problem we're facing. Why are all the prisons being attacked? You know, stuff like that. But they are underwater, under current.
The reason I'm taking the time to ask all these questions is because I'm trying to see at what point the ball got dropped. Because Kuje Prison, I'm hoping the Ministry of Interior knew, was housing Boko Haram terrorists. I'm hoping the Controller General knew was housing Boko Haram terrorists. So if you get intel that this prison is going to be attacked, these terrorists are going to release some of their members, I would imagine that it would become a matter of urgency, to become a matter of priority. So I'm trying to see who and who and who were in the chain of command, and at what point did communication break down, and then we got what we saw with the prison attack. That's why I'm asking all these questions.
Yes, I understand perfectly, you know, and I can tell you that a fundamental mistake was made. Fundamental. And the fundamental mistake is that you don't put terrorists in a medium-level prison. You know, you don't do that. You put them in a separate facility, or you put them in a maximum security, you know, prison, not in a medium-sized prison. You know, because those prisoners are not supposed to be there. Now, you remember there are political people of
prisoners there as well.
In there, you have all kinds of people in there. Then you now bring these hardened people in there. You know, I don't know how they'll even be interacting inside the prison with the others. And our prisons are not designated, you know, whereby they are compartmentalized and you put these people separately from these people.
I see.
I'm sure in the evening everybody might have come out smoking cigarette or lying around and talking.
I see.
And from what we heard, somebody has even told us, that when he was in prison, there were Boko Haram prisoners that were there when they come in. When they bring food for him from outside, which is not supposed to be, sometimes he shares the food with some Boko Haram people, and they had a very good rapport there. You can imagine, and this is open source information that everybody knows about.
Right.
I don't want to mention his name, but you maybe you already know the guy I'm talking about.
Right.
So this is the situation where, you know, these fault lines. These fault lines have been there, but nobody was taking it seriously.
I'm trying to understand why. Why was nobody taking it seriously?
I don't know. Maybe they don't know the essence of what they are doing, or they are complicit with some of these things that are going on. We know that there are people in government, like former President Jonathan said, there are Boko Haram sympathizers in his government, and it's very possible we still have them, you know. So you do things, you are supposed to. Even when the terrorists said that they want an exchange of their people,
right?
That alone would have raised the alarm to tell us that, hey, see, these guys are there, you know, and now that they are even trying to, they want them released, right? So we better tighten that security there so that in case they attempt, they will not succeed. But we let it be, and they attempted and took all of them away, and here we are.
If you just tuned in, Lagos, I've got a former assistant director of the State Security Service on the show with me. His name is Dennis Amakri. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. You're listening to The Big Hard Fact. And today I'm asking, how can the security situation be salvaged? You have been a consumer of the event of the past few weeks. Insecurity seems to have gone from bad to worse. On Friday, Garba Shehu said, he's the president's media aide, he said that the security situation was a deteriorating one, and the anxiety about insecurity is so high that you have minority members of the National Assembly openly talking about impeaching the president, who they say isn't responding enough to the situation, the security situation. They don't think he's responding seriously enough. So for the first 20 minutes of this hour, I've been talking to Mr. Amakri about Garba Shehu called the deteriorating security situation. And we're also going to talk about what the present administration and the incoming administration can do to rectify it. Now, I have to ask about money, Mr. Amakri. This administration has budgeted 4.85 trillion naira for security since it was sworn in. Have Nigerians received value for that money, in your opinion?
I don't think so. I don't think anybody has received value. because that trillion that you're talking about could do a lot of things. And I don't think Nigerians have got the benefit of that money. And then, of course, you would want to ask, where is the money? You know, where is the money? And I can tell you also that that money didn't get to the security people altogether. Because one thing we've discovered, observed in this particular things that are going on, is that there is huge corruption going on. Huge, very huge. Whereby 1 billion will be allocated to the army, and then we discover that they will not get that 1 billion. You know, because you know that budgeting is different from appropriation. You know, So they will say, okay, 1 billion has been approved for you, but take 300 million for now. You know, so these are the kinds of things that you see. Those are the kinds of things that happen. Some people even might even, I don't know, but to release money is a very big issue. And when it comes to national security, it should be a priority. But we don't see that. We don't see that in the sense that, one, we are prosecuting a war. Believe it or not, this is a war. And in a war, people are dying. And when people die, normally the normal thing to do is to replace them. Our recruitment is not going as much as it should. Because when you count the numbers, the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, then you go and count police, NSCDC, DSS, NIA, all of them are together. It's not up to 1 million. It's not up to 1 million. Now, when you compare it to other countries that have the, you know, comparative population with us, and if I let me take Egypt, for instance, which is smaller than us in population. Their police alone, is 1 million. So how do you now spread these people? You know that it is because the police cannot handle the situation.
That's why that the army is involved.
Ask the army to come in.
Right.
You know, so why don't you hire more policemen, train them, because it is training. It's not because your army go and work with police or they are a terrorist, go and call the army. Because that same training of, you know, the proper training of handling kidnapping, the proper training for handling terrorists can be given to the police too. You know, but for some political reasons or whatever, I know that years back when we had the military government, the police was weakened because they felt that the was being very tough, you know. Carriers were even all reallocated to the army, you know, in this country. So we have situations like that. Even the army itself was weakened because they felt that if you train them and give them more arms, they will go and plan a coup, you know. So we've not got out of that mentality yet, whereby you leave them the way they are. And then, of course, they are there struggling and patching and managing whatever comes to them. So, you know, there are a group of people that we should salute because they've tried in at least keeping the country together. If they have not been working, I don't think I would be having this conversation with you.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back from this break, I'd love to talk to Mr. Amakri about ransom payments. Garba Shehu has said that as long as Nigerians are willing to pay ransom, terrorism will continue because the ransoms are a source of funds. So when we come back, I have questions about that. I also have questions about the steps that communities are taking, for instance, to pacify terrorists. This is hard Hot Facts on 99.3 Nigeria Info. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. Dennis Amakri is on the show with us as our security expert. You can join the conversation as well when we return from this break. 0700-993-993-993. WhatsApp is 080-959-75805. Share your thoughts, share your comments on Facebook as well. Nigeria Info, 99.3.
More talk, news and sports after this.
A performance of sheer class.
Uncommon speed.
Terrific strength.
Uncommon power.
And how good was that?
Uncommon skill.
Becomes the Commonwealth champion.
Showmax Pro brings you the 22nd Commonwealth Games, where a common passion meets uncommon performance.
It's 5:28 at the moment. We've got on the show with us a former assistant director of the State Security Service, Dennis Amakri, and we're talking about the security situation in the country. How can it be salvaged? I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. Mr. Amakri, before the break, I mentioned that Garba Shehu has said that as long as Nigerians are willing to pay ransom, terrorism will continue because the ransoms are a source of funds. In your assessment, has government given families of kidnapped victims a workable alternative to paying ransoms?
I'm really surprised that Garba Shehu are talking like that, because there are situations where you go and do a job, go home and do some homework instead of coming to make that kind of statement. Because I tell you one thing, ransom payment is no. I don't believe in it, and I've said it many times.
Okay.
Don't pay ransom.
Right.
But it's not just don't pay ransom. If you don't pay ransom, then make sure you go after the terrorists.
Okay.
You know, you just don't tell people don't pay ransom and then we all go back to sleep, And I've said it even with the governor of Kaduna State when he was saying that he's not going to pay ransom again. I said, beautiful. Because before we were saying don't pay ransom, he was paying. He was paying these bandits. And then we were shouting and shouting, don't pay ransom. And then he was getting tired because he discovered that after they finished using the money, they come back again.
Mm.
And he said he's not going to pay again. And it was from that day that they started giving him hell in Kaduna State. Don't pay ransom. But when you don't pay ransom, make sure that the security agencies are ready with a quick response to deal with any case of kidnapping. Because when you don't go for rescue, these guys are going to be there beating up your hostages. And then, of course, in South America, what they usually do, they send you their finger. A finger of one of the hostages. They'll send it to you that this is their finger, and tomorrow we're going to remove another one if you don't pay.
Mm.
All right?
Mm.
And in this case, we don't have to, just allow it like that. When you don't pay, you go after them. And that's what they usually do.
Hmm.
That's what SWAT teams are set up in different police organizations. They have SWAT teams, special weapons and tactics. They are the ones that will go out and they will know how to extract the hostages.
Do we have that set up here?
We don't. And the Inspector General of Police, at the end of, if you remember very well, at the end of NSAS,
mm-hmm.
they said, okay, we are going to cancel NSAS,
mm-hmm.
and then instead of that, we are going to set up
SWAT. Right.
In fact, I saw some people being trained as SWAT, and I was saying, well, do they have the real people who can train them? And, are we going to buy the weapons for them?
Mm.
And then make sure that it's effective, because every police organization needs a SWAT team. It is not the regular police that you send, and that's why sometimes we fail, because when certain things happen, we send the regular police, and the regular police are not trained to do that.
Mm.
So we have to reorder our priorities and know exactly what order, you know, who is supposed to do what. And then, of course, call out those people who are trained to do certain things at certain times.
Okay. But like I was saying before the break, beyond ransom payments, we're seeing communities taking steps to pacify terrorists. So, for example, we saw the community in Zamfara State that turbanned a known and wanted terrorist just to get him to accept peace. What should government and the security forces be doing to make people feel like they don't need to take these types of steps?
You know that this particular insurgency or war that we've been fighting for more than 10 years is also a war of the hearts and minds of the villagers.
Okay.
A war of the hearts and minds.
What do you mean?
Because, in fact, I remember that when Ansaru came into some localities in the Northwest, they were actually even giving them water. You know, during Salah, they were giving them rams and cows to celebrate their Salah. You know, and they tell them to pay taxes. If you pay taxes, we're not going to do anything to you, and then you can go to your farm and you can live gently and nicely. And this is what we, our own forces, are supposed to do. Because when our forces go there, sometimes they take over a village, dislodge the terrorists, and then they go away. Because now the military will do that job, and then the police are supposed to take over from them and then bring law and order, and then, of course, a stable life to the people. When you don't do that, it creates a vacuum. Now, when the terrorists are coming there, fighting, and at the same time, trying to help the people and stuff like that, they are in a bind. They are in a bind. They will seek for self-help. They will want to, you know, please these new guys, the new masters that are here, so that they will not kill them, you know. So you find out that, like, when they talked about that traditional ruler who gave a Tobanin a chieftaincy to these
terrorists.
I personally did not blame him too much.
Okay.
Because he might be doing it for the goodness of his people.
Right.
You know, because what he does will make these people not to attack his people.
Right.
And then when you don't see the presence of government in such ungoverned space, they go in there and then they will do whatever they like. Now it's left for you to placate them or you die. You know, so these are the kinds of equation that we find ourselves.
You know, we've been hearing, and I like that you made the point about self-help earlier on. We've been hearing the call from different northern governors for people to defend themselves. So, for example, the Zamfara governor set up vigilante groups at emirate level. The federal government is not too keen on that setup. And I wonder if you think there are advantages or disadvantages to this approach.
Well, the thing is this. To be very honest with you, and to, you know, check the nitty-gritty of this thing, you have to realize, and I think many people don't know this, but issues of kidnapping are state crimes. They are not federal crimes.
Right.
They are state crimes. And the state governors are supposed to take care of it.
So in this situation where there was the kidnapping on the Abuja-Kaduna rail, are you saying that the Kaduna state government should handle that?
Of course. And that's why they are even very specific about the Kaduna state governor, where they are threatening that the next time they will kidnap him. You know, it is the Kaduna state government, you know, but what they have to do, because they will tell you, oh, I'm not the CSO, I'm the CSO, but I don't have the power. It's the federal government, you know, that's checking their responsibilities. They are supposed to work with the police. the army, the DSS that are in their state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was an assistant director in Lagos, we have every Monday we have State Security Council meeting with the governor. And the governor will go ahead and table issues that we all discuss, and any responsible, any agency that is responsible will go ahead and do it. You know, you don't wait until you hear from Abuja, because that's a misnomer. Many people, when they don't want to do what they are supposed to do, they will say, oh, the commissioner of police is not listening to me. I can't give him orders because he will go to, he has to go to Abuja first and stuff like that. All governors receive security votes, billions. And what are they doing with it? And that's why we're saying that, see, we should have state police, because then you are starting to localize the crime. When you are localizing the crime and putting people to fight the crime in their locality, you know, then we can have results. And all these security votes, which at present day are the pocket money of the governors, should be put in good use by expending it on the police.
So you're saying, that there's a lot more that state governors can be doing about security in their states than simply wait for the federal police? Okay, like what? Because say, of course, that a state governor says, "Oh, I don't have control over my commissioner of police," and I'm saying this, and I'm thinking specifically about, I believe it was Rotimi Amaechi when he had Joseph Mbu as the commissioner of police in River State at the time. You know, so they often say these things. The state governors are often saying, "I'm just this chief security officer in name only. I cannot control the commissioner. There's not a lot I can do because the federal government, the police is federal controlled. The army is federal controlled." When NSARS happened in Lagos and the soldiers went and killed people at the Lekki toll gate, you had the Lagos state governor saying, "I do not control the army. The federal government controls the army." You're saying now that, there's more to that statement than meets the eye. So what's the true picture so that we can finally settle this this I don't control security talk, you know?
Every governor, I told you, I was an assistant director in a state, and we go to Security Council meetings chaired by the governor, and it happens. Some states don't have Security Council meetings. I know, because for some of my colleagues that are in the States, I am very much in touch with them.
Okay.
And they tell me, look, there is no Security Council meeting here. The governor, anytime he likes, he can just call you and talk with you. And then, you know, you go ahead and do what you
have
to do.
Why? Is it because their states are safe, or?
Maybe their states are safe. Some governors take the safety of their states for granted, whereby they feel that, oh, nothing. That's why I'm even telling people now. Some people will be, oh, what is happening in Abuja, or even in the, no, what's happening in Maiduguri will not come down to us. Now it is in Abuja. And some people say, oh, it's in Abuja, it's not going to come down to this side. It can't come to Lagos. And of course, many people don't know, but the DSS have actually arrested terrorists who were targeting the Third Mainland Bridge in Lagos some years back. You know, so these are the things that happens. When you have security people, you must work closely with them. And the governors usually will tell you, anytime they complain, watch it. You will see that it is either opposition party, you know, opposition party, the center is different from the state.
Okay.
You know, so they don't have this. But why is Lagos State working? Lagos State is working perfectly. Perfectly. Their security is super.
Okay.
And compare the population of Lagos to the security in Lagos and how the governor has gone ahead. All the governors, not only this one, have gone ahead to make sure the trust fund that is set up, the security trust fund, has been very, very, you know, rudimentary to what the whole system is. And of course, they don't spare it when it comes to security.
Right.
But you find out that there are other states, they don't. There are some states, the governor is always in Abuja. It is when payday time, maybe end of the month, like today, you see the governor is in the state. And everybody knows that the governor is around. I've been in a state like that.
What state?
You don't see the governor.
What state was that?
Yes, I can tell you about it. When I was in Taraba State, you know, sometimes you see the governor, they travel a lot. They are not around. And then by the 28th, you see that the Commissioner for Finance had gone to Abuja to bring money. And then he will bring his money. And everybody knows that money has come. You know, even local government people, everybody, civil servants. And then governor is also around.
I'm wondering why he needs to go to Abuja to bring the money. Can't they just transfer the money? Can't he sign it by PDF?
In those days, you have to come and collect your money.
Oh.
They don't do... I think the banking system, let me to be very honest now, to be fair, in those days, when I was there... Transferring of money was not a common thing.
I see. Okay.
Transferring of money was not common.
Okay.
Even telephones were not
very common. But that's an aside. Let's not get sidetracked. You know, let's come back to what exactly the governors can actually do in their state as far as security is concerned. Because quite frankly, all the time you hear the governors say, "Oh, I don't control security. I don't control the security apparatus." You're saying that's not entirely true. So what are the things they can be doing as governors in their state? What should the Kaduna State governor, for instance, be doing about the train victims who have been kidnapped and who were recently seen on camera getting whipped by the terrorists who have them under lock and key? What should El-Rufai be doing in Kaduna State?
You know, Rufai has a lot to do, but I will come back to the point of what governors can do in their states about security. For El-Rufai, I think he committed himself, you know, so he's trying to right the wrongs that he has done, you know. So,
what do you mean when you say he committed himself and he's trying to right the wrongs?
He committed himself because, you know, most of this. People have been there. Like I told you, El-Rufai was paying the bandits that were in the forest. He was giving them money.
Right.
And then suddenly he discovered, he started saying that he's not going to give them any money anymore.
Right.
And he didn't give them again. Then they now threatened him that if you don't do that, you are going to deal with you.
Right.
He said that he will not give them money. Even if they take his child, he will not pay ransom.
Right.
They heightened it. They went to Jengebe. They now take students out there. And then he was scared. They now removed his son from the school. Right. Remember?
Right, I remember.
And then the next thing was that they made the place so ungovernable and they are running all over the place. So he has his problem with them. And they said it. They said when they first took the train hostages, they said, "We are not looking for money. The government knows what we want." And they are referring to Kaduna State government. "The government knows what we want. And if they give us what we want, you know, we'll release the hostages." That was not done. And apparently, he's very much familiar with it. He knows where they are. The SSS has been telling him. In fact, he said that he was listening to their conversation. So all these are there. But what he can do is to strengthen the security agencies to fight this. Who are these guys? Which kind of gun are they carrying that the Nigerian army has not seen before? He can buy weapons for them. He can send them for specialized training. He can hire trainers to come and train them.
And these things you're talking about are realistic things that he can actually
very,
do.
Very, very realistic things that he can do as a governor. You know, he can do them.
These are things that the Constitution empowers him to do as governor.
He's the chief security officer of his state.
Hmm.
You know, if we have to break that down, what does it mean? He's the commander of the security forces in his state. He cannot say that, they have to go to Abuja before they go. Okay, fine. Let them go to Abuja. If there is no police officer, IG, or even the director general of SSS that will say that, they come and tell him, look, the governor says he wants to send us on training, and he will say, no, don't go, because he's just a governor. I don't think so, you know.
You don't think so, or you know so?
I don't think so, and I know that it has never happened.
Okay.
Because most of the things that you tell your head from a state, they are always supportive.
Okay.
You know. They are very happy when the governors will buy vehicles for the police.
Right.
Sometimes you see the IG will go there and receive them himself.
Right.
And then thank the governor. You know, it's the same thing.
You're saying that any state that has serious insecurity problems, the state governor isn't doing as much as they should be doing.
That is very correct.
Interesting.
That is very correct.
Okay. Now, this weekend, vigilantes in Washe Plateau State successfully resisted an attack on their community. They didn't get any help from the police or the military, and this is not the first time that we've heard a story like that. Assuming vigilantes are here to stay as a way to fill the gaps in the security infrastructure, how should the police, the military, and intelligence agencies be working with them? Do you think they should be working with them?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. Because, you see, when you have vigilantes, they are actually, you see, the involvement, or should I say the evolution of state police, is from this little self-help that happens, even in the United States. It was not like they have a unitary system whereby states started asking for their own state police. No. Here, they have sheriffs.
Right.
They have little towns.
Right.
And in the town, they have a lawman,
right,
you know, who is usually a sheriff. And he is supposed to maintain the law.
Right.
And then from there, it grew until it went into, you know, state police.
Right.
Now, or city police. Some cities have their own police.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, you know. So it is that way whereby it evolves. And right now, in fact, let me give you a very good example. Many people don't understand or see it that way. Lagos State is a state with state police.
That's right.
You know,
they
have state police, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you see LASMA, you know, all those law enforcement, CAI or whatever, these are all law enforcement agencies.
Right.
And they will evolve. Right now, what they don't have is, I think some of them even have the power of arrest. But when they start having power of arrest, power of prosecution, and stuff like that, you know, what else are we asking for? You know, so many people have these vigilantes.
Mm-hmm.
And these vigilantes, they will evolve and become state police, because what are they doing? They are helping the security of those states.
National Assembly is considering a bill to ban Okadas nationwide as a way to improve security. What's your take on that?
That is I don't think it's a very good decision. To what end? You know, we have more serious things. The National Assembly is really disappointing me, because it is the arm of government that is faltering seriously, you know. The state police is not happening because National Assembly is so sitting on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are the ones allocating the money, and the monies are not going down to the rightful people to be used. You know, so I'm worried about the National Assembly. How can you ban Okada in the cities or in the local areas where transportation is a problem? the terrorists who are using bikes still have their bikes. So when you ban it, are you also banning for the terrorists?
Terrorists?
No. You know, they are going to be riding their bikes, and they know where to buy their illegal fuel in their black market, and they will continue using it to be attacking villages. So which one are you talking about? The banning you are banning, to what end? What will it do? You know, so you come up with all these proposals or laws which are not effective. You know, I don't think it's a waste of taxpayers' money.
Okay. My guest is a former assistant director of the State Security Service, Dennis Amakri. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. I wish you had more time to keep going. I have a few more questions. But thank you for sharing your thoughts on the show on these issues with us. We do hope you have a fantastic day.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Lagos, that's all the time we have. Thank you for your messages on social media. We've got this comment here from Benson Okoli, who says, Sandra, believe the Nigerian police at your own risk. Tony says, please, can we bring back the firing squad? Terrorists arrested and convicted should face capital punishment to serve as a deterrent to others. Prince from Ajah seems to think that there's complicity on the part of political operatives. How can troops be waiting for high order before opening fire on terrorists? So many comments on WhatsApp. I wish I had time to take all of them, but I do not. But I will thank you for being a part of this conversation today, for listening, for sharing your thoughts on social media, for trying to call into the conversation. Really, really appreciate it. Tomorrow on Road to 2023, Wike is shaking things up in the PDP. Let's talk about that from 5 o'clock. Of course, at 3 p.m., three of the biggest stories from tomorrow will feature on the Big Three. And then, of course, the step down starts at 6:15. The step down is a new segment on Hard Facts. It's really good. You shouldn't miss it. It returns tomorrow at 6:15. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili on social media. S Ezekwesili everywhere. Those were your Hard Facts. Lagos, good night.
Being in Lagos traffic can drive you crazy. From the uncomfortable seat to conductor screaming.
And I want to assume that you would run, because I want to give the listeners context for the conversation.
In 2019, you were running mate to Atiku Abubakar. What did you learn then that you will not repeat this time?
Yes, when is the president coming out to address us?
There's a few things. One, I have a burden and a passion for young people.
The fact that you have elected a man does not mean then you begin to order him around. The president will do whatever is good for the country at any given time.
Mr. Adesina, isn't the president responsible to the people?
What should the next president do to root out stakeholders who are complicit?
You fire those that need to be fired are fired.
It's looking like a brand new Chelsea, attacking with so much fluidity. And what can you say about that, Martin? I know you follow Chelsea quite closely.
I live close to the Chelsea training ground. That's what you mean by that. I'm not a Chelsea.